KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
I would like to see more truth from the Trump team, because this affects Ukraine and not in a positive way.
President Zelensky fires back after President Trump falsely says Ukraine started the war with Russia.
For Wednesday, February 19th, it's All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Scott Detrow. This hour, Elon Musk is helping the Trump administration sack federal workers and pull apart federal agencies.
What is the goal of mass layoffs?
The idea that this exercise of slashing the headcount of the federal workforce is about cost savings makes no sense.
Also, war in the Middle East reverberates in unlikely places.
Like Ireland, which may soon pass a bill banning trade with Israeli settlements in the occupied territories.
This is one of our hardest year in history. We've seen Ireland take more and more anti-Israeli steps.
First News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. A federal judge in Manhattan says he needs more time to decide whether a criminal case against New York City Mayor Eric Adams should be placed on hold. Adams' attorneys and attorneys for the Justice Department argued today a trial would distract Adams from his duties. Here's NPR's Brian Mann.
Mayor Adams was indicted on corruption and bribery charges last year, but the DOJ now wants federal judge Dale Ho to shelve the case, in part so Adams can focus on helping round up migrants living in the city without legal status. Critics say the DOJ agreed to halt its prosecution in exchange for Adams' assistance cracking down on illegal immigration. Speaking in court under oath, Adams denied any such quid pro quo deal. Judge Ho said he'll issue a ruling soon. Meanwhile, New York Governor Kathy Hochul is weighing whether to remove Adams from office. After four of his deputy mayors quit this week, Hochul said the controversy may be making it impossible for Adams to run the city. Brian Mann, NPR News, New York.
President Trump's nominee to lead the Department of Labor faced questions from a Senate committee today. As NPR's Joe Hernandez reports, lawmakers asked Lori Chavez de Remer what she thought of labor unions, the minimum wage, and more.
Chavez de Remer is a former Republican congresswoman from Oregon. While in Congress, she co-sponsored legislation called the PRO Act, which would make it easier for workers to unionize. Under questioning from Republicans, Lori Chavez de Remer called the legislation imperfect and said she supported the ability of states to pass right-to-work laws, which limit union efforts. Asked by Democrats whether she thought the federal minimum wage should be increased, Chavez de Remer said she recognized it hadn't been raised in over 15 years, but that some jurisdictions might need to have a different minimum wage than others. Joe Hernandez, NPR News.
Arab leaders gather in Saudi Arabia Friday to exchange ideas for an alternative vision for the future of Gaza than the one President Trump has laid out. More from NPR's Aya Boutraoui.
The Gaza Strip lies in ruins after nearly 16 months of war and intense Israeli airstrikes. Trump says to break this cycle of violence, the U.S. should take ownership of Gaza and turn it into a real estate project after all Palestinians living there are permanently relocated to countries like Egypt and Jordan. When Arab leaders meet in Riyadh on Friday, they'll review alternative plans for Gaza's future being drawn up by Egypt. Hamas has called Trump's plan ethnic cleansing. Israel's prime minister calls it a remarkable idea. Israel's military has been instructed to prepare to implement the plan. But any post-war reconstruction of Gaza will need not just Israeli backing, but also Arab support to fund the tens of billions of dollars the UN says is needed to rebuild and the possible deployment of troops for security. Aya Boutraoui, NPR News, Dubai.
The turmoil at federal agencies in Washington is beginning to hit home. Even Republican lawmakers finding themselves begging the administration to release funds they appropriated. That includes money for things like biomedical research and programs supporting Native American tribes. You're listening to NPR. Two people are dead after a mid-air collision involving two small planes in the skies over southern Arizona. National Transportation Safety Board says it's investigating the collision of the planes near an airport on the outskirts of Tucson. It is the second fatal aircraft incident in the state in roughly a week. Last week, a pilot on a private jet owned by Motley Crue singer Vince Neil was killed when the plane veered off a runway. The hydrogen-powered truck company Nikola has filed for bankruptcy. The company's Chapter 11 proceedings could result in the company's assets being sold off and the business being wound down. As NPR's Camila Domonoske reports, it's an enormous end to a once buzzy company.
Once upon a time, there were two zero-emission vehicle startups named after Nikola Tesla. But where Tesla raced into history, Nikola just rolled downhill. Literally. An exposé revealed that Nikola pushed a truck down a hill and claimed it was proof it could drive, among other untruths. That led to the ouster of the CEO, a settlement with the SEC over fraud, and Nikola never really recovered. Bankruptcy records show there were no offers to acquire the hydrogen truck maker in one piece, based in part on the, quote, long and uncertain path toward profitability. So now it might be sold for parts. Camila Domonoske, NPR News.
Residents of the English village of Godstone won't be going home anytime soon, apparently. That's after a large sinkhole that was definitely not a godsend for the town swallowed up parts of the main street and left about 30 buildings there in danger of collapse. Officials worry that could lead to ruptured pipes and possible explosions. Engineers blame the sinkhole on a burst water main. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Doris Duke Foundation, which aims to support the well-being of people and the planet for a more creative, equitable, and sustainable future. And listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Scott Detrow.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. The presidents of the U.S. and Ukraine escalated their feud today. On his Truth Social platform, President Trump called his counterpart, Volodymyr Zelensky, a, quote, dictator. That was in response to Zelensky accusing Trump of living in a, quote, circle of Russian disinformation. Zelensky was speaking with a small group of reporters at the presidential palace in Kyiv this morning, and NPR's Joanna Kakissis was among them. Hi, Joanna.
Hi, Mary Louise.
I'm so struck by those words I just said aloud about a feud between the presidents of the U.S. and Ukraine. It speaks to what a different world we find ourselves in than just a month ago. You were at Zelensky's press conference. Tell me what else he had to say.
So yes, Mary Louise, Zelensky said he is worried about this thaw in relations between Moscow and Washington and how this appears to have revived Kremlin talking points about Ukraine. He's worried that President Trump is repeating them, like the fact that Ukraine started the war. On that point, of course, it's Russia that launched a full-scale invasion of Ukraine 3 years ago, and it's Russia that continues to bomb Ukrainian cities every day. And just to remind you, we were sitting in a presidential palace, which is sandbagged to protect against Russian attacks. And Zelensky calmly said, look, President Trump is not seeing the facts here.
I would like to see more truth from the Trump team, because this affects Ukraine and not in a positive way.
He said Ukraine's fate should be decided based on the facts, on the reality on the ground, and not on interpretations based on Russian propaganda.
Joanna, to that point you just mentioned, President Trump going out of his way to say Zelensky is unpopular, that people in Ukraine hate him. What did Zelensky say in response to that?
So he called it a Kremlin talking point. Russian President Vladimir Putin has actually repeatedly called Zelensky an illegitimate leader because Ukraine has not held elections. And I should say, Mary Louise, because of the war, there is martial law. And according to Ukraine's constitution, elections cannot be held during martial law. And though Ukraine has actually explored the possibility of holding elections during the war, it's just not a popular idea for many reasons, including the fact that voting centers could be targets for Russian attacks. Nevertheless, President Trump demanded that elections take place and claimed President Zelensky only has a 4% approval rating. Trump cited no evidence for this number, though.
Well, and I'm sure among many things during a war, it is difficult to conduct reliable polling. But is there data? Is President Zelensky unpopular?
Well, according to independent surveys I've seen, he's less popular than he was before the war, and he has many critics. But the most recent survey I did see, it's released by an independent pollster that's very respected here. It shows that his approval rating is about 57%, which is actually higher than President Trump's. Zelensky said the 4% figure cited by Trump is Russian disinformation.
Unfortunately, President Trump, and we have great respect for him as a leader of people we also respect very much, he lives in this space of disinformation.
Mary Louise, these are the most pointed remarks Zelensky has made about Trump. Zelensky has been trying very, very hard to bring the Trump administration and President Trump to Ukraine's side. But I noticed that Zelensky wasn't angry or agitated when he was talking. He was tired but direct, saying, look, I'm not going to give up on this. This is not my first battle.
In the meanwhile, there is one senior member of the Trump administration actually in Ukraine. This is Keith Kellogg, Trump's special envoy on Ukraine and Russia. He is in Kyiv. Do we know how Zelensky will try to make his case to him?
So Zelensky has said he wants Kellogg to speak with Ukrainian civilians and soldiers, maybe even visit the front line, so he can see reality as Ukrainians are experiencing it. And he hopes what Kellogg reports back to Trump will change the president's mind.
Will change President Trump's mind. Okay, NPR's Joanna Kakissis reporting there in Kyiv. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Billionaire Elon Musk is helping the Trump administration orchestrate mass firings of thousands of federal workers. That's been the centerpiece of Musk's Department of Government Efficiency, a team focused on slashing costs, and it's a tactic Musk has used in his business career. But as NPR's Bobby Allen reports, the Silicon Valley-style moves are up against different realities in the federal government.
In the past month, Musk has gleefully posted on X about sacking federal workers and pulling apart entire agencies. Talking to Fox News host Sean Hannity Tuesday night, Musk said this is what the mass layoffs are about.
In order to save taxpayer money, it comes down to two things, competence and caring.
Musk claims you have to care enough to find ways to cut spending, and you have to be competent enough to figure out how. As to opposition from Democratic lawmakers, some judges, and government workers who are suing.
I guess we must be over the target or doing something right. You know, if they wouldn't be complaining so much if we weren't doing something useful, I think.
In Silicon Valley, when tech companies need to cut costs, firing lots of people is a useful way to save money. Musk, who runs six companies, knows this. After Musk bought Twitter in 2022, he got rid of 80% of the staff. That's because for many tech companies, employee salaries and benefits are the number one expense. Not so in the federal government, where personnel costs make up just about 4% of the entire budget.
The idea that this exercise of slashing the headcount of the federal workforce is about cost savings makes no sense. And it makes no sense because it is not the primary cost center.
That's Max Steyer. He runs the Partnership for Public Service. It's a nonprofit focused on improving government. He says there are about 2 million federal employees nationwide.
People should know that's about the same size as it was in 1969. So headcount has actually not grown, even in absolute terms, and it's shrunk in relative terms to the whole population.
A recent Washington Post estimate put it another way. Laying off a quarter of the entire federal workforce would only reduce federal spending by 1%. So if slashing civil servants isn't going to save much money, then why has Musk launched a campaign against rank-and-file workers? I asked author and historian Thomas Frank this question. His 2008 book, The Wrecking Crew, examined how Presidents Ronald Reagan and George W. Bush also tried to declaw the federal bureaucracy. Frank says what Musk and Doge are doing are part of a long conservative tradition.
The Chamber of Commerce had a slogan back in the 1920s. They used to say, more business in government, less government in business. And this has always been kind of close to the heart of how Republicans have administered the state.
In other words, replace career government workers with business types under the banner of saving money. Trump has also made his personal resentment of what he calls the deep state clear. He insists the federal bureaucracy is undermining him out of political animosity, which is why Musk has tapped loyalists as part of Doge. They're a crew of mostly Silicon Valley engineers and managers trying to terminate staff and completely dismantle agencies. Frank says what Musk and Doge are doing to shrink the size of government already goes well beyond what past Republican administrations tried to accomplish, thanks to Trump's buy-in.
He is this embodiment of this long-standing Republican dream. In a lot of ways, he's doing a lot of the same things that Ronald Reagan set out to do, that George W. Bush set out to do, only he's doing it a lot more forcefully.
Frank says if Trump and Musk really want to cut government costs, they'll have to find ways to attack the biggest government expenses, Social Security, health care, and defense. Together, that's 60% of U.S. spending. Bobby Allen, NPR News.
Support for All Tech Considered comes from Arm, committed to delivering innovative, advanced computing designed to enable worldwide companies to unleash the capabilities and experiences of AI. The future of AI is built on Arm. Arm.com.
Members of the Columbine community and beyond are mourning the loss of Anne Marie Hochhalter this week.
Hochhalter was one of the survivors of the infamous 1999 shooting at her high school in Littleton, Colorado. She was shot twice and paralyzed.
On that April day, in 1999, Hochhalter was sitting with friends eating lunch outside when two armed students arrived at the school and killed 12 others and one teacher. The shooters then took their own lives.
She described her experience in an interview with U.S. News and World Report in 2009.
I felt a stinging in my back when I thought that this was the end. You know, I saw a red thing move out of the corner of my vision, and it was an ambulance. They weren't really sure if I was going to make a full recovery. And you know, barring the spinal cord injury, I did make a full recovery.
6 months after she was injured in the shooting, Hochhalter endured another tragedy when her mother, Carla, died by suicide.
I know that, you know, dealing with my mom's death was very much harder than what happened at Columbine, just because I think that it shocked me because, you know, I was injured by a gun, and the fact that, you know, she committed suicide with one was very hard to understand.
After her mother died, a family that had lost a child at Columbine reached out, the Townsends. Over time, the Townsends called Anne Marie an acquired daughter. In an interview with Denver's 9 News, Sue Townsend said Anne Marie did not consider herself a victim, she was a survivor. Townsend described her as fiercely independent, someone who wanted to use her experience to benefit other people.
In the years after the Columbine shooting, she did just that, drawing on her own experiences to advocate for people with disabilities.
And despite everything she had been through, Anne Marie found power in forgiveness. More than a decade after the shooting, she publicly forgave one of the shooter's mothers in an open letter she posted on Facebook. She talked about it in a 2016 interview with NBC News.
Bitterness is like taking a poison pill and expecting the other person to die. And it only harms yourself. If I can help her by telling her that I forgive her, maybe that's one less person that she has to worry about, if she even does worry about me.
Anne Marie Hochhalter was found dead at home on Sunday from what are believed to be natural causes caused by complications from her injuries.
And if you or someone you know may be considering suicide, call or text 988 to reach the Suicide and Crisis Lifeline.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Thank you.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one platform. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. From the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping someone else less fortunate is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at LodestarFoundation.org. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Scott Detrow. War in the Middle East reverberates in unlikely places, like Ireland. That country is weighing a controversial bill that would ban trade with Israeli settlements in the occupied Palestinian territories. Ireland would be the first country in the Western world to do so. And the last time Ireland led a boycott, it changed history. NPR's Lauren Freyer begins our story in rural County Wexford, south of Dublin.
Old black and white photo.
That's me there.
This is definitely the 1980s.
Yeah, now look at the hairstyles.
In 1984, Mary Manning was just out of high school, working a grocery store cash register and annoyed by all the rules.
Just stupid things, like if you're 3 minutes late, you got a warning.
So she and a few other cashiers picked a political fight.
In fairness, we didn't know anything about South Africa at the time. We hadn't a clue what was
kind of just to spite their bosses, they decided to boycott goods from South Africa because it was under apartheid at the time. Mary was first to refuse to ring up a customer who was trying to buy South African grapefruit.
I just said to her, like, I'm sorry, we are boycotting South African goods in solidarity with the people of South Africa. She was grand. She just said, okay. And she put the two grapefruit and she left them on the checkout. But the manager who was behind me saw.
Her manager suspended her, so Mary went on strike. Her co-workers joined, and their union backed them up.
Mary, what gives you the right to tell people what they should and shouldn't buy in the shop?
Well, we're not saying that people should or shouldn't buy them. We're saying that we should have the moral right not to handle the goods.
That's Mary 40 years ago being interviewed in the picket line. Reflecting back, she says that's where she came of age.
It was only as we were standing on the picket line that we started to read what was happening in South Africa. It just became much, much more important to us.
They stayed on strike for nearly 3 years and were nicknamed the most dangerous supermarket workers in the world until 1987.
After their lengthy action over South African goods,
when not only did their supermarket give in, their entire country did. Because of this boycott, Ireland that year banned imports from apartheid South Africa. It was first in the Western world to do so.
Kind of remodeled the whole kitchen when we got here.
Yes.
Mary went back to private life, marriage, kids, a cute rescue dog, and a house near the sea south of Dublin. But now she's back on the streets, 40 years on, lending her clout to another boycott movement.
I haven't done this in a long time, so free Palestine!
Ireland is now poised to become first in the Western world to ban imports from Israeli settlements in the occupied Palestinian territories. Those are settlements the United States, the United Nations, and the European Union all consider illegal.
And in practice, what that would mean is that if you're a supermarket here and you're stocking dates that have been produced in illegal settlements, you'll be asked to pull them from your shelves. If you refuse to do that, you could be fined or sent to prison.
Connor O'Neill is a Christian aid worker who helped draft the Occupied Territories Bill. We met at the gates of Ireland's parliament, where the bill is expected to pass this year and where citizens have been gathering every month to rally for it.
The Occupied Territories Bill!
With Mary Manning's example in mind, he says.
There is a street in Johannesburg named after Mary Manning, and I think the stance we took as regards apartheid South Africa in the 80s is really to the front of public consciousness here.
Last year, a poll found 71% of people in Ireland now think Israel is an apartheid state. Now, Israel does not see itself that way, and Ireland didn't always. Many Irish supported Israel in its early years. But perhaps because of Ireland's own history of British occupation, as Israel annexed and occupied more Arab land, Irish public opinion flipped, and it's now one of the most pro-Palestinian countries in the world.
Why now? This is one of our hardest year in history, and we've seen Ireland take more and more anti-Israeli steps.
Dana Ehrlich is the Israeli ambassador to Ireland. We spoke as she was packing her bags. Israel is closing its embassy here. Because since the October 7th Hamas attacks and the Gaza war that followed, Ireland has recognized Palestinian statehood, joined a genocide case against Israel at the International Court of Justice, and said it would arrest Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu if he ever sets foot on Irish soil. The ambassador says those actions go beyond policy critique.
That has crossed the lines to incitement. So when you are solely focused on punishing the only Jewish state, that is an anti-Semitic move.
The ambassador says Jews here feel vilified and that Israelis who came to work in Ireland's tech sector are leaving. Dublin is decked with Palestinian flags. People wear buttons that say pass the occupied territories bill. The bill's only domestic critics, there are very few, even many of them say they don't disagree with it. They just think it's unnecessary. The bill will not affect the $6 billion in annual trade Ireland does with Israel proper. It only applies to Irish trade with Israeli settlements in the occupied territories, which is
very, very, very little, if any at all. This would be more of a symbolic gesture.
Daniel Mulhall was Ireland's ambassador to Washington during the last Trump administration when this bill was first drafted. It sparked concern among U.S. companies, many of which have branches in Ireland that also do business with Israel and with settlements. Mulhall convinced President Trump not to retaliate against Ireland back then when it was only a draft bill. But when it passes,
there are particular risks for a trade-dependent country like ours when you have the imposition of tariffs and trade wars breaking out all over the place.
Ireland is already in Trump's sights because of its trade surplus with the U.S. Why rock the boat, Mulhall asks, for a bill that's only symbolic?
For one reason, because I firmly believe that this is the right thing to do.
Frances Black is the Irish senator who wrote this bill, and she's worried. Because even though all of Ireland's main political parties support it, they're spending a lot of time revising and amending it, tweaking the language to make sure it doesn't clash with EU trade law, and votes have been delayed.
Will they carve outs or exemptions, or are they going to water it down? I don't know. And the Irish people will be very, very upset by this, I can guarantee you.
Because they so overwhelmingly support this.
So a 20-year-old cashier said she wouldn't handle South African fruit.
Back in the 80s, after Mary Manning refused to sell that South African grapefruit, she was blacklisted. For years, no one in Ireland would hire her. But news of her strike reached a certain prisoner who'd been held on Robben Island. And when he was freed, he thanked her.
The sacrifices they underwent, so many thousands of miles away from us.
And when Nelson Mandela died, Mary was a guest of honor at the funeral in a giant football stadium in Johannesburg.
Long live the spirit of Nelson Mandela, long live. Long live.
And it was just unbelievable. It was unbelievable to be there. Like a kind of, you were right in what you did, you know, that kind of way, because we used to not doubt ourselves because we knew what we were doing was right, but no one seemed to kind of believe that.
She says it took years for her to feel vindicated. Back then, Mary Manning was an outlier. This new boycott has widespread Irish support, but if it passes, it could make Ireland the outlier. Lauren Freyer, NPR News, Dublin.
This is NPR News.
People are preparing to rebuild after the Los Angeles wildfires.
Well, it's getting better every day.
That's good.
You know, the worst part of the shock is over. Now it's looking at the cleanup.
But should neighborhoods at high risk be rebuilt at all? Tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
It's All Things Considered. From NPR News, I'm Scott Detrow.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. A new film has taken the Chinese box office by storm.
And the $2 billion animated movie is sending a clear signal to Hollywood.
Hollywood films still have a home here, but there is going to be pressure on Hollywood to make movies that actually resonate with local audiences.
Now news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. President Trump is continuing to attack and threaten Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. This comes as the U.S. and Russia are leaving Ukraine out of talks aimed at ending a now three-year-old war. More from NPR's Mara Liasson.
Trump repeated Russian talking points today when he posted that Zelensky was a, quote, dictator without elections. Zelensky was, in fact, duly elected. Trump also warned Zelensky that he better, quote, move fast or he's not going to have a country left, unquote. Trump has increasingly taken Russian dictator Vladimir Putin's side in the effort to resolve the war sparked by Russia's invasion. As Trump engages in talks with Russia, without Ukraine at the table, he seems to be more and more aligned with Russia's goals, allowing Russia to keep captured Ukrainian territory, barring Ukraine from ever joining NATO, and blaming Ukraine for the war. Mara Liasson, NPR News.
Civil rights groups are suing the Trump administration over executive orders they say are illegal. NPR's Sandhya Dirks reports the Legal Defense Fund and Lambda Legal are suing on behalf of three nonprofits, including the AIDS Foundation of Chicago.
The nonprofits provide housing, work programs, and medical care to Black, queer, and trans communities. The lawsuit claims the Trump administration, by banning anything it labels diversity, equity, and inclusion, and trans people, violates the right to free speech and due process and prevents the nonprofits from helping those disproportionately impacted by systemic racism and bigotry. Lambda Legal CEO Kevin Jennings says the consequences of the president's orders are more than just overturning decades of civil rights.
If people cannot get preventative care, if people cannot get care once they have HIV, people will die.
Trump has said his executive actions are about doing away with programs that he calls discriminatory. Sandhya Dirks, NPR News.
This is NPR. This week's Billboard charts are out, and Kendrick Lamar is reaping the benefits of a Super Bowl spotlight. NPR's Stephen Thompson has the report.
Kendrick Lamar's Not Like Us is the number one song in the country after more than 6 months away from the top spot.
They not like us. They not like us. They not like us.
Zooming from number 15 to number one on the strength of the rapper's recent Super Bowl halftime show. The chart surge extends well beyond that one Grammy-winning hit. Lamar has the week's top three songs as well as number five. Over on the albums chart, Kendrick Lamar's album GNX returns to number one, while two of his older albums, Damn and Good Kid, Mad City, return to the top 10 for the first time in years. Stephen Thompson, NPR News.
The new Trump-appointed Social Security chief is contradicting claims by the president and Elon Musk that tens of millions of dead people are getting payouts. Acting Commissioner Lee Dudick said it's true that improper payments have been made, but the numbers cited by Musk and the White House are overblown and inaccurate. Dudick says the confusion has to do with missing or incomplete birth dates that default to a reference point of more than 150 years. But that doesn't mean they're getting paid by the agency. Stocks finished slightly higher on Wall Street today after a mixed day of trading. You're listening to NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Fisher Investments, As a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From Subaru, who along with its retailers is partnering with Operation Warm to provide more than 130,000 children in need with brand new necessities like coats, shoes, and socks. Subaru, more than a car company. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Scott Detrow. Access to abortion is starting to open up in Missouri. The state had one of the strictest abortion bans in the country. But back in November, voters approved a constitutional amendment to end it. But rules in place for years, which controlled abortion clinics, have kept the clinics from resuming the procedures. Now a court has put those rules on hold, and St. Louis Public Radio's Sarah Fentum is here to explain what it means. Hey there.
Hi.
So that is a lot of back and forth. So let's start with this. There was a court ruling on Friday that cleared the way for abortion access. At this moment, is abortion treatment available in Missouri clinics?
So people from a Planned Parenthood clinic in Kansas City announced over the weekend they had performed an abortion there. So at least one has happened. And here in St. Louis, the organization's leaders say they want to begin making appointments for medication-assisted abortions at a clinic here. So far, it's only those two clinics and one other that plan to resume abortions here in Missouri. And Planned Parenthood officials say the organization will potentially expand to other locations or even look at mobile clinics in the future. Mm-hmm. Planned Parenthood Great Rivers CEO Margot Riphagen says clinics want to go back to work. Here she is.
Our commitment is that we will ensure that the will of the voters is instituted and that we can provide abortion care here in Missouri no matter what.
And spokesman Nick Dunn from the St. Louis Clinic told me they're waiting on some final approvals from state regulators before they can schedule appointments there.
Can you step back and remind us how we got to this point? Because Missouri is a state that had a near total ban. This was a ban with no exceptions for rape or incest.
Right. Missouri Republicans had created a so-called trigger ban that the state put in place literal minutes after the Supreme Court overturned Roe versus Wade. But Missouri voters last year passed a ballot initiative that put the right to an abortion up until the point of viability into the state constitution. But laws about facilities and how clinics operate and how they had to perform abortions were still on the books. And Planned Parenthood argued with those laws in place, the clinics couldn't start abortions even after Amendment 3 passed. And a judge appointed by a Republican has now issued an order that puts those requirements on hold. And that means clinics can again offer the procedure here.
Got it. So how are anti-abortion groups reacting to all of this?
Republican lawmakers and anti-abortion activists say they're pushing really hard in the state legislature this year to put abortion restrictions back on the books. Missouri State Senator Mary Elizabeth Coleman was one of the authors of the state's trigger ban, and she was outside Planned Parenthood's St. Louis clinic earlier this week with other anti-abortion protesters.
This is about death and destruction. This is not about protecting women's health, protecting their options. It's about saying that for a woman to be successful, she must pay the price with the life of her child.
And she mentioned one proposal that would put another constitutional amendment to Missouri voters that would only allow abortions in the case of rape or incest. And finally, many who are watching this play out expect our state's attorney general, who's named Andrew Bailey, to go back to court and reimpose some of the old rules.
Okay, so this issue is still up in the air. This is not settled permanently. But broadly, how does Missouri fit in now with what is going on in other states?
States have been passing their own laws, and people have been voting on abortion rights since 2022's Supreme Court decision. And so it varies state by state, and Missouri's close to a lot of states that have near-total bans, and it's possible we'll see patients coming into our state now to get the procedure.
That's Sarah Fentum of St. Louis Public Radio. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
And now to New York City, where the fate of embattled Mayor Eric Adams is still in question. Today, a federal judge in Manhattan heard arguments that bribery and corruption charges against Adams should be put on hold. This comes after the Department of Justice made the controversial request to dismiss those charges. The judge questioned attorneys for both Adams and the U.S. Justice Department, and at times sounded skeptical about the government's motives for suspending the case. NPR's Brian Mann was in the courthouse today. He is here with us now to help us understand what is going on with one of America's most high-profile mayors. Hey, Brian.
Hi, Mary Louise.
Start with the central question. Did the judge suspend the federal charges against Mayor Adams?
He did not, and this was a surprise. Usually when the DOJ makes a request like this, courts sign off. It's pretty much pro forma, but Judge Dale Ho, the federal judge here in Manhattan, made it clear he views this case differently, these corruption charges against Mayor Adams. And his deepening relationship with the Trump administration, they've sent shockwaves through New York's political culture and through the DOJ itself. Judge Ho today described this, and I'm quoting here, as a very complicated situation. So for now, he's still reviewing this request that the case be shelved. He says he'll try to rule soon.
Now, for the Justice Department, Acting Assistant Attorney General Emil Bovee was in the courtroom today. What did he say?
Yeah, Bovee offered a blunt argument to Judge Ho that this is a case where the DOJ and the Trump administration have a lot of discretion. Bovee insisted repeatedly the goal here is to protect national security and to help Mayor Adams get back to work dealing with migrants in the city who lack legal status. Bovee said Adams should be allowed to do that job, and I'm quoting here again, do that job unburdened and unhindered by a criminal trial. One thing we learned in court today, Mary Louise, is that Adams' federal security clearance was stripped by the Biden administration while this case was underway. Huh. Bovee and Adams' attorneys argued today that made it harder for Adams' city administration to help deal with security threats.
What about, Brian, all these questions about whether there was an improper quid pro quo deal, the lenient treatment for Adams in exchange for his help in cracking down on illegal migrants? That's something that critics, including some former Justice Department attorneys, have suggested might have been in play. Did that come up?
Yeah, it was a major theme. At least seven DOJ attorneys have resigned over the Trump administration's handling of this case, saying there appears to be political interference in this criminal prosecution. Three other former federal prosecutors have attempted to file a brief with the court urging Judge Ho to reject this request that the charges be suspended. So one thing Judge Ho explored in detail today is the fact that the DOJ is suspending this case without prejudice. And what that means is that the Trump administration can bring these criminal charges back and indict Adams again anytime in the future. That means the Trump administration is going to have a lot of leverage now over Adams. So Judge Ho asked explicitly whether Adams felt threatened. And speaking under oath, Adams said there were no deals, that he wasn't threatened. The DOJ's Bovee also said repeatedly that there's no improper leverage being exerted here.
We have been talking about legal issues. What about political issues for Adams? Because these criminal charges have created a political firestorm. Four of his top aides resigned this week. Did he speak to that today?
Yeah, he walked right past me going into the courtroom today, and he said, you know, this is all part of the process. He's really tried to act as if it's sort of business as usual. He seemed very upbeat in the courtroom today. But of course, meanwhile, Governor Kathy Hochul is considering removing Eric Adams from office. She hasn't yet made that decision. So what we're waiting for now is not just Judge Ho to rule on these criminal charges, but also Governor Hochul to make this political decision about Adams' future.
NPR's Brian Mann bringing his reporting there from the courthouse in Manhattan. Thank you, Brian.
Thank you.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. With the Trump administration and its DOGE team moving quickly to make big cuts across so many agencies, it has been hard for the usual government watchdogs to know what's really going on. So they are making new tools. Mary Childs from our Planet Money podcast tells us the story of one of them.
Lauren Bauer is a researcher at the Brookings Institution, a nonpartisan think tank. She pays a lot of attention to government social programs, so when the administration started talking about spending cuts, she knew exactly where to check to see just what was being cut.
I had experience with something that's called the Daily Treasury Statement.
The Daily Treasury Statement. It's a simple PDF published every business day showing how much money the U.S. Treasury has sent and to whom through its secure payment system. And this is not a tremendously popular document. It's a small accounting report published quietly on a Treasury website. She showed it to me.
This is fiscaldata.treasury.gov. So if you click it, it opens. Look, I've already done it once today. You can get the Daily Treasury Statement.
This PDF has a very official, fancy Treasury insignia at the top. It's two columns. On the left, deposits, incoming money. On the right, money going out to Medicaid and Veterans Affairs and Customs and Border Protection, the Library of Congress, the SEC.
People could see whether the Trump administration had actually stopped the flow of funds.
That's extraordinary access the public has. And I think it demonstrates the values that our government does place on transparency and communication.
That's Rachel Snyderman. She's a managing director at the Bipartisan Policy Center. And she traces this kind of digital access back to bipartisan laws starting in 2006 that mandated that all federal spending data be displayed publicly online in one place.
Before that time, there was really no single way to track government spending across agencies, and it made it really difficult to use data to inform evidence-based policy decisions.
You know, so American citizens can see if their tax dollars are being spent wisely or are being wasted. Because if the public doesn't know the facts, Snyderman says, it can't make informed decisions. Transparency is crucial to a working democracy.
It's really powerful what can be done with all of this data.
So when Lauren Bauer of Brookings started to see reports of funding freezes and that maybe USAID was being defunded, Bauer and her team decided to take that Daily Treasury Statement data and make it into a tool people could read themselves.
We built the roughest version of it basically on day one.
Her team took hundreds of older Treasury statements and set up a way to automatically add the new data as it is published each day. The result is an interactive graph showing over time what money went to each line item. And on Monday, February 3rd, they hit refresh and one of the lines, the one for USAID, drops to zero.
That was when it became clear that this tool could in fact show that the money was not sent to USAID.
So even without official announcements, Bauer can see precisely what programs are still getting money, which aren't, and what's changing down to the day. Mary Childs, NPR News.
On the latest episode of Planet Money, you can hear more about the act of impoundment and what money a U.S. president can legally withhold from spending.
Support for Planet Money comes from Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com.
You're listening to All Things Considered.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. If you are feeling fed up with winter, the icy weather, gray skies, short days, lack of sunlight, you're not alone. But hey, spring is right around the corner. And other countries have to endure weather like this for much longer chunks of the year. So how do they do it? Are there lessons we can learn from our Nordic friends? Life Kit host Marielle Sagada looked into this for a recent episode. She is here with us now. Hey there.
Hey.
Are you feeling as done with winter as I am?
You know, some days, yes, absolutely. But I have found this year I'm actually enjoying it more because of this episode that we did. I talked to Carrie Leibowitz. She wrote a book called How to Winter, and she has a PhD in psychology. She studied happiness in places that have long, dark, cold winters like the Nordic countries. Mm-hmm. And she said, you know, first of all, our mindsets really matter here, and research shows that. So question for you, do you love everything about the summer, or are there things that annoy you about it?
Humidity. Mosquitoes, sunburn. I could go on, yeah.
No, there are indignities to every season, right? And it's the same thing with winter. There are downsides. And then there are the delights. We want to focus on the delights, right? The way the ice crunches when you walk on it, the very particular blue color of the winter sky at dusk, or the chance to watch a fat little robin hop in the snow and eat berries like I did this weekend.
Oh, or a roaring fire. I'm a big one for roaring fires. Mm-hmm. Although you talk in this episode that we actually have to get outside, spend time in nature, even when it's really cold.
Yes. And Carrie says in the book, there's this saying, there's no such thing as bad weather, just the wrong clothes, right? So bundle up, get yourself outside. This is also really good for your mental health. And consider reclaiming an activity that you love during the summer. You can still have that barbecue at the park. You can still go to the beach. You can still color on the sidewalks with chalk as long as they're not iced over. Just get yourself a good coat.
Yeah, this is the advice I need. Buy more clothes. We'll get you through all the seasons.
We have episodes for you on that, too.
I love it. That is our Life Kit host, Marielle Sagada. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
For the past decade, the highest grossing movie in a single market ever was a long-awaited sequel from a galaxy far, far away.
There has been an awakening. Have you felt it?
That is Star Wars The Force Awakens, which earned more than $936 million in the U.S. But this month, moviegoers in China awakened as a force and blew up that Death Star of that Star Wars record. NPR's John Ruwitch tells us about the film that did it.
Ne Zha 2 was released just in time for the Lunar New Year holiday, which is typically a good time for films. It's kept up momentum, and good doesn't start to describe how well this movie's doing. According to box office data from Maoyan, an independent site that tracks ticket sales in China, it's become the highest grossing animated feature ever. It's also the highest grossing non-English film ever, and the only one to cross the $1 billion threshold at the box office. And it may double that. So I went to check it out. Before taking my seat, I meet 8-year-old Ko Su Tong, who's with her dad. She's excited, so I ask her to tell me about the plot of the movie, which is a sequel. She says Ne Zha and his friend Albin, who are mythical children, were left with only their souls after the first movie, and so they got new bodies. Albin's new body only lasted for a few minutes, and his soul ends up in Ne Zha's body. Hilarity ensues, including, she says, Ne Zha mistakenly peeing in a vat of drinking water. Okay, it's complicated, but the film is much more than a comedy. The plot has twists and turns, action and heart. There are dragons and gods, there's family drama and epic fight scenes. All revolving around a kid who tries to do good despite his hot temper. Part of the secret of the movie's success is that it's steeped in Chinese history and mythology. It's one-of-a-kind IP. Ne Zha is the kind of story that many in China grew up hearing. For Western audiences, think Peter Pan meets Greek mythology, though even that doesn't capture it.
This is basically representing a golden era of Chinese animation.
Thomas Weick is an assistant professor of international communications at the University of Nottingham in Ningbo, China. He analyzed thousands of online reviews and comments about the movie, and he says the film is a hit because it's got first-rate animation, a fast-moving plot with well-known characters, and it was written in a way that appeals to every demographic in China.
It's prioritizing pertinent social issues, but it's not political messaging. I think it's prioritizing entertainment, basically. And it's able to balance that cultural authenticity with that commercial appeal today.
The director, who goes by the name Jiaozi, or Dumpling, spoke to state TV around the time the film was released. He said conditions were ripe for a hit.
When a country develops to a certain level, when the artistic demands of the people reach a certain point, a market like this will naturally exist.
As of Wednesday, the film had grossed some $1.7 billion. I spoke with Daniel Manwaring about the movie about a week ago. He's the CEO of IMAX in China. At the time, more than 170 million tickets had been sold.
Think about that. That is half the population of the United States. Okay, when to go see this film.
The number is now more like two-thirds. According to Mao Yan, No Jia 2 is now forecast to rake in more than $2 billion at the box office. That's approaching what the movie Titanic made. In China, it's become a huge point of national and cultural pride. State media have trumpeted its success as a win for the country. The film opened in the U.S. on Friday. Regardless of how well it does, Manwaring says what it's done in China sends a message. The market here for smart, culturally sensitive content done well is alive and kicking.
Hollywood films still have a home here, but there is going to be pressure on Hollywood to make movies that actually resonate with local audiences.
And Hollywood filmmakers, he says, will have to adjust. John Ruich, NPR News, Beijing.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Workday. Workday is an AI platform for forward thinkers, dedicated to transforming the way business leaders manage people and money today so they can transform tomorrow. Workday, moving business forever forward. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. From Dignity Memorial, helping families today to protect their loved ones tomorrow. Planning celebrations of life in advance can give families peace of mind. Learn more at...
Fiber Plus Internet is now available in Sandpoint and King Cove. GCI offers high-speed internet in your community at the same plans and pricing as in Anchorage. More information is available at gci.com/internet.